Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 95-year-old Joe Pintacura of Prunedale, California. I want to thank one of our listeners, Ray Bennett, who hears the program on KION out of Monterey and Salinas, for letting us know about Joe and his memorable experience as a teenager aboard the destroyer USS Craven.
The Craven was, I think it was kind of an unusual ship because it had 16 torpedoes on it. I mean, the ship with torpedoes and big 5-inch cannon guns and a bunch of 20-millimeter guns. And there was only one stack. It was called a single stacker. USS Craven DD-382. Turned out to be, you know, pretty busy ship in the Pacific.
Well, let's hear about it. And how did they welcome you to the ship? Was there an adjustment period or something you had to get used to?
I got aboard ship. I was a seaman, you know. And what happens, they assign you to either the forecastle, the midship, or the fantan, the rear end of the ship. And you do whatever they tell you. Scrape paint, paint, scrape paint, paint. And then they assign you a battle station. And I was assigned to a 20-millimeter gun as the shooter. And I only weighed about 110 pounds at that time. And the first time I pulled the trigger on that thing, I couldn't control it. It was just boom, 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 boom. And I was supposed to be shooting at a target that some plane was pulling. Man, it's a lucky thing I didn't shoot that plane down. Because I'll tell you, I just could not control that gun. And the gunner's mate, who was in charge, says, "Get him off that gun before he kills somebody." And so they got me off of there, and they says, "Okay, you can load the shells onto the 20-millimeter. Well, they come in a great big canister, real heavy. I could hardly lift that canister. So you got to take the one that's emptied out. You got to take that off, and you got to put the other one on. And it jammed right away because I couldn't slam it into the 20-millimeter. And so they get him off that. He can't be a loader either. So then I was just in line bringing up ammunition. You know, they hand it from one to another. But later on, there was an opportunity to work in the sick bay. One of the corpsmen transferred to a hospital ship. And I applied, and they gave me the job. So then they gave me a big book that says nursing on it. And next thing I know, I'm learning acetylsalicylic acid, which is an aspirin, and giving people stuff for constipation, and mouthwash. And then I got to doing closing cuts and small wounds, stuff like that. But we had a first-class pharmacist mate aboard and a chief petty officer who was a pharmacist mate. And then, of course, we had a doctor. So I got all the menial jobs. I had to, whatever they tell me to do, keep medical records, make sure supplies were available, and give shots, too. Yeah, kind of a good job.
And when you were heading out to sea, what was going through your mind? Were you wondering if you're ever going to see Shirley again, see your family again? Were you thinking you might not come back? What do you think was really on your mind at that time?
The only time I really, really was scared is when they assigned two destroyers to go all the way into the Japanese island harbors. Guam was one of them. I think Saipan was the other, Tinian. We went to a bunch of them, and we would go, the USS McCall, which was another destroyer, we would go right into their harbors and bombard the island. And the purpose of that was to have them actually open up their a barrage on that, because we had an aircraft that was taking pictures so they could find their, you know, where they're shooting from, because their planes from the carriers were going to go in next. And basically they said, you know, say your prayers because we're expendable. It was really a big surprise when we were bombarding the dickens out of them the very first time we did it, that they didn't fire back. And I could throw a baseball and hit the ground. And we did that island after island. And we had a cruiser that was further out at sea that was also bombarding from there. And for all I know, there could have been a battleship behind him. But it was just a small unit that had that job. And that's when I started to thinking, yep, I'm not going to be able to go home. And that was kind of sad. But then, thank you, Japanese, for not shooting at us. We wound up going back and escorting carriers, which was one of our primary jobs. And that was pretty good duty because when the pilots came back and they bounced off the carrier, for one reason or another, we would pick up the pilot, you know, if he got out of the plane fast enough. Sometimes they didn't. And we picked up two or three pilots. And I, being in the sick bay, got to meet them because they brought them always down to the sick bay for examination. And then they would break open the liquor locker. And I had the key to the liquor locker. And the pilots would always say the same thing. Are you guys going to San Francisco? So that was a good part of the job. And then in battle stations, I would always be assigned with the medical equipment, either midship or aft, or up on a bridge, whatever they would put me. But, you know, it turns out that the Japanese kamikaze guys, they don't want destroyers. They want carriers. They could care less. We were really safe being a destroyer. The carriers were the ones that were in danger.
Well, and you guys were part of their line of defense, but I want to go back to what you shared there. When you and the McCall pulled into these harbors, you said close enough to throw a baseball, and you're trying to sniff out the Japanese guns. So for people who didn't get the picture there, basically you're the bait trying to expose the Japanese, and you're extremely vulnerable. Like you said, you're expendable, and you knew it.
Yeah, it was a surprise that they didn't fire back at us, because we figured, you know, we wouldn't be there very long, and we'd be damaged or sunk. And at Guam, another strange thing happened. There was someone flashing SOS at us from Guam. It turned out to be a guy named Tweed. And he was an American Navy guy who was hiding out from the Japanese for 2 years. And the McCall was closer to him doing the SOS, and they actually volunteered to get into a gig, you know, a small craft and a small boat, and go get him. They could have been going into a trap. We let's find out. But they did rescue him, and Tweed was rescued, and they even made a movie about that, No Man is an Island, later on. So I think it was George Tweed.
But you remember seeing those signals?
Oh yeah. We were almost side by side in the bay, in East Bay. Not too much room in the bay, you know. We're pretty close.
And when you said, you know, for general quarters, you'd be with medical equipment in different parts of the ship. So you're just standing by in case someone's wounded?
Right.
How often did you have to actually act on that?
Well, you're at general quarters every daylight. You know, you're dark at night, and when daylight comes, you're at general quarters. And when dusk comes, you're at general quarters again. Because it could be submarines out there. Could be, who knows? You just had to be ready for it.
And did you have some scenarios that you still remember where you did have to try to help somebody, care for guys who got hurt?
Not from being shot at, but from falling down and dropping ammunition. You drive a 5-inch shell on your foot, and man, you got a foot of trouble for the rest of your life. Yeah, and those kind of things happen. A couple times, fellows fell overboard, and we rescued them. And then, of course, just normal being having a cold, a common cold. They'd be down there in the sick bay, you know, just coughing, sneezing. But as far as the enemy doing some damage on our ship, the only damage we got was from a typhoon, and that was a major damage.
Well, let's talk about that, because I've had a lot of guys share that typhoons were worse than the enemy when they went through them. Tell me what you experienced and what that felt like.
At one time during that typhoon, somehow I got on the bridge. I'm not sure how I got there. I can't remember how I got there, but I was there. And I was out on near a searchlight and the signal light. And I had to take some line and tie myself around that signal light. Otherwise, I'd have been gone. Because that ship went in every direction. It was like a rain, heavy rain. I recollect thinking it was a cork, a cork in the ocean, just being bounced every which way. And we lost 3 destroyers in that typhoon. They ended up calling it Admiral Halsey's typhoon. It turned out that he was supposed to meet General MacArthur somewhere, and he wanted to make that meeting, and he wasn't going to let a typhoon stand in his way. I think he made the wrong move, but in any case, our ship got busted up so badly that we limped back to Pearl Harbor at a slow speed. And then Pearl Harbor, we got a little welding done, and it wasn't enough. We had to go through the Panama Canal up to the Brooklyn Navy Yard and get the rest of the ship, you know, welded together.
And, you know, I've talked to some guys from those destroyers that went under, and they lost a lot of shipmates in that, and they were very fortunate to survive. And I know what happened to their ships, but it sounds like yours really went through the ringer too. Can you help us understand what it felt like? What kind of thoughts go through your mind? Because you have no control over any of this.
Well, it was unbelievable. At the time that it was happening, I was dunked in the water. I don't know how many times. That ship should have sunk too. You know, you go over 90 degrees, you normally don't come back. But the ocean's force throws you one way and throws you another way. It's like you're going to be doomed one minute and then rescued all by the ocean itself in the storm. It'd be a combination of lightning and thunder, and it was like a fantasy. And I think back sometimes, was I really there? Did it really happen to me? Yeah, just like unbelievable. We were really fortunate.
What do you do in a moment like that? Are you thinking about stuff back home? Are you praying? Are you just trying not to think about anything? What goes through your mind?
I think I was just watching. I didn't think when we were bombarding from the ports, I thought I was going to die. I didn't think that during the typhoon. I was just thinking, this is the darnest storm I've ever been in. It's just, it's horrible. And I never thought the ship would sink. I just thought we'd bounce around until the storm was over. And basically, that's what happened.
So what was it like coming back into New York after that?
Well, it was good for me because my sweetheart came from Chicago to Brooklyn, New York, and we got married in a courthouse. We got a license. We went over to the courthouse. They were having an automobile accident case, and we walked in the door, and the bailiff says, "What are you two doing here?" And we said, "We want to get married." And he tells the judge, "These two want to get married." And so the judge holds up the the court proceedings, and he questions us out loud in front of all these people, you know, because we were kids. We thought we were growing up, but we were kids. And when he found out that we actually were going together for over 2 years or about 2 years, he says, "Okay, let's put you together." So we had to use the bailiff for a witness, and the reporter there was a witness. And as soon as he pronounced us man and wife, that old court cheered. It's like we had an audience, you know. Hey, congratulations. And that was on June 15, 1945.
So you weren't quite 19, and how old was Shirley?
Her birthday was in November, so she was actually 17, turning 18.
So she had to have her parents' permission.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and that was an easy thing for her to do because her parents were divorced, and she had to get both her father and mother for some reason.
And I'm sure people are trying to put themselves in your shoes. The war's not quite over yet. You don't know when it's going to be over. Why not just wait? Why was it so important for you to get married right then? What was the conversation you two had?
We just missed each other so badly. It was just so good to get together. It was like, never want to part again. Just love is strong, really strong. In fact, she stayed in Brooklyn while our ship, after it got repaired, we made a trip to Southampton, England, and back. So I saw her again when we returned. And then the next time we went to Plymouth, England, and unfortunately, we didn't go back. We went to the Mediterranean, which was the war was over by that time in the Mediterranean. And so we were like, our job was to go in every port and represent U.S. in a good way, you know, not drunken sailors. Mm-hmm. No, our job was to spread goodwill and get acquainted with people.
And, you know, back to this wedding, because I know a lot of guys, you know, I've had people on this show say, we wanted to get married because we didn't know what the future held. And others said, we didn't want to get married because we were afraid one of them's going to die. You guys get married as teenagers. Did anybody tell you that it wasn't going to last or that you two were making a foolish decision or rushing to it or anything?
Yes, we heard that a lot from people. They say, you're too young to get married. You're too young to get married. I said, well, we're in love. What else can we do? We're just crazy about each other. So we're just going to disregard everybody's warnings and do it. And it turned out that they were all wrong because we never even talked about a divorce, never even talked about meeting the wrong person. It was like it was a perfect marriage, 71 years. And then going together for 2 years, 73 years with that sweetheart. She was the girl. There's no doubt about it. I guess I was the guy.
No doubt about it. And that guy has some more World War II memories to share with us when we come back, including a couple of unique experiences with the enemy that altered his perspective and what his trip to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Bay Area meant to him. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page for photos and a short video of 95-year-old Joe Pinacura, and we'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.